Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast. I'm Doug Krisner. You can join Brian Curtis and myself for the stories making news and moving markets in the APAC region. You can subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcast and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
We wanted to take a closer look at the conflict between Israel and Iran, and we're joined by Kirsten Fontenrose, now president at Red 6 International. Well, it doesn't appear at the moment, Kirsten, that Israel will respond in the short term to the Iranian attacks this past weekend. Israel has reopened schools and Iran has opened its airspace. But we do have these other complications. Janet Yellen, for instance, saying that the U.S. will apply new sanctions or more sanctions on Iran. What are some of those options that the U.S. holds at the moment on sanctions?
The U.S. already has a host of sanctions on Iran, mostly based on counterterrorism laws in our domestic law books. But U.S. law authorizes us to sanction Iran's energy sector, the financial sector, including its central bank, shipping, construction, mining, textiles, automotive, manufacturing industries, its arms trade, as well as components of their government, including the Supreme Leader and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the IRGC. Plus any entities that conduct transactions with these or otherwise support them. So it's a really broad writ. We expect that any new sanctions will be focused on export of petroleum and petroleum products or import of components for their drone or missile programs. A lot of those components are commercial and off the shelf, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps often sets up cover or front companies that will import from unwitting actors who provide parts to the commercial sector. So sometimes it's a whack-a-mole game of the U.S. contacting these companies and saying, we know you didn't mean to do this, but you're going to have to stop doing it. One of the criticisms of the Biden administration has been that the sanctions that have been in place have not been enforced. So we'll probably see a lot more in the way of enforcement as well. In fact, the Congress, the U.S. House of Representatives, passed four new bills yesterday, two of which really are intended to kind of hold the Biden administration to enforcement, and two others that focus on, for instance, secondary sanctions and the humanitarian exemptions piece in the existing sanctions. I'm happy to go into a little more on those sanctions if you'd like.
I'd like to get your sense on to what extent Iran is reliant on Russia for some of these weapons that we're talking about.
The trade is actually in the other direction. So Russia tends to stick by Iran. And a lot of this is because Russia is relying on Iran for much of the weaponry it is using in its war on Ukraine. It has a couple of its own really capable drones, but the drone it's been having the best luck with is the Shahed 136, which is an Iranian model. And Iran agreed to a technology transfer that is allowing Russia to build these domestically now. They expect to have four factories up in coming years, and some are already being produced. We don't know how much is disinformation, how much is sort of a military deception campaign, or how much is really being produced of those drones domestically yet. But the reason this relationship is meaningful for Iran is not only the income from those arms transfers, but also because of Russia's veto in the UN Security Council that has been used and will probably continue to be used to protect Iran, to defeat attempts to mitigate its import of a lot of these weapons components, to block arms embargoes, to hold it responsible for certain kinds of support to proxy militias around the rest of the Middle East. Russia's been a very useful aid to Iran in the Security Council with that veto. So A lot of the technology is actually going the other way, but the political support is coming this way.
And the sanctions on Russia haven't led to China, for instance, not buying oil from Russia or getting gas. So you wonder if some new sanctions are applied by the United States and even the EU, because the EU could well join in with some new sanctions. But if the sanctions aren't enforced, and we're seeing that, you know, in day-to-day life, you wonder whether or not really a pledge to crack down more is more important than new sanctions.
Exactly. And that is part of what the House of Representatives is thinking. So, for instance, we're seeing one of these bills that was just passed is called the Iran-China Energy Sanctions Act of 2023. So it's been in process, but there's been a sense of urgency, obviously, this week. And it expands the secondary sanctions regime involving Iran to include all transactions between Chinese financial institutions and the banks in Iran, which, of course, are already sanctioned, that handle any sort of petroleum product trade. So you're seeing China wrapped in there and, you know, these additional secondary sanctions coming on. Congress is also saying, OK, administration in Washington, we want you to prohibit the Treasury from issuing any licenses to a U.S. financial institution to engage in trade with Iran other than humanitarian aid. And we want you to oppose IMF assistance to Iran. And in order to make that happen, we're going to make it law. So they've passed the No U.S. Financing for Iran Act of 2023. Of course, these are just coming out of the House. You know, they're not complete yet. There's also the Iran Sanctions Accountability Act of 2023. All these names sound the same, but this one requires the president to issue regulations that ensure those humanitarian exemptions to U.S. sanctions don't actually go toward facilitating terrorism internationally or trading in weapons of mass destruction. Then there's a final one.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just going to get your take on what we know of what's happening at the war cabinet in Israel and the extent to which the conversation is going on between Washington and the war cabinet to the extent that the U.S. has any influence over what happens next.
It's an ongoing conversation between Washington and this war cabinet, and then Europe is weighing in. Arab governments are weighing in. A lot of folks are out from outside are trying to encourage restraint, saying you run a couple of risks here. One, you start a retaliatory cycle. Two, the world is giving you a little bit of goodwill because you shot down with all of our help 99% of this barrage of weaponry that came at you. And this has reinstated belief in the fact that Israel has impenetrable air defenses. You know, after October 7th, they lost a little bit of that belief in their strength of defense because of the intelligence failures on October 7th. Mm. But now with the defeat of this deluge in the sky, they have restored some of that. And it's probably going to be really good for their defense industry, their domestic defense industry. And it's good for their relationships in the region. People want this kind of partner. And it required this coalition of Arab partners with Israel that CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command, has been building for years to create this umbrella of air and missile defense. But all of these partners are saying, please don't start a cycle of escalation and please don't make it hard for us with our publics, because they are not particularly fond of the idea that we are defending, quote unquote, Israeli sovereignty right now. They are instead messaging that this is truly an issue of their own sovereignty and that no matter where a drone or missile comes from, they will knock it out of their airspace. They've all been Jordan, UAE, Saudi, even Egypt have been really clear that this is not an issue of defending one country over the other. This is an issue of national sovereignty and the desire not to see these things fall out of the sky onto their own citizens.
Kirsten, are we learning that sanctions just don't really work as well as perhaps administrations believe they would? Because we mentioned the Russian sanctions, and now we have all these sanctions already on Iran. And, you know, by the way, if the EU were to join in, would that make a difference?
It makes a difference on the messaging, and it makes a difference whether we can get other parts of the world to also join these sanctions, places where the U.S. doesn't have as much leverage. Perhaps we get countries in Africa, Latin America, places used as transit, places used for cover companies. But it really all comes down to enforcement and evasion. And those two things impact how successful any sanction is going to be. So the Biden administration, while in talks about a renewed nuclear agreement, let off the pedal on the sanctions enforcement, hoping that this would be a signal of goodwill to the Iranian regime and they would then be willing to negotiate in greater faith. That didn't happen. And again, as I mentioned, you're now seeing Congress kind of tie their hands on, potentially tie their hands through the House, we'll see the Senate says, on enforcement. And then Iran has been really active in trying to devise ways of evading sanctions. Some of this is operating outside the U.S. and Western financial systems. So, yep. but their clients for this kind of activity happen to include the largest purchaser of energy in the world, which is China.
Kirsten Fontenrose, president at Red 6 International.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Business Week, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We're joined now by Bloomberg Opinion columnist Julie Wren, talking about her column on China Wang Ke and the company denying that it's running into difficulty. Wang Ke is China's second largest property builder by sales. And I think Julie feels as this says a lot, maybe everything, about what's happening right now in the China property market. Julie, it's always a pleasure. Expand on that. How is Wang Ke kind of giving us a window into everything that's going on with the property market in China?
It can be surprising how fast China's property developers run out their cash. Wang Ke, by the way, is nothing like a China Evergrande or Country Garden. It is one of the best run and well-managed companies in China. But what we are seeing is that the cash level is dwindling really fast, even though it's achieving positive operating cash flow. In other words, the company's core business can be still profitable and lucrative, but in the end, it's running into cash troubles.
Well, its cash is not sufficient to cover the bonds maturing this year. So, I mean, it needs extra funding. It needs that extra capital. I think it would be difficult to sell shares right now or even debt. So I suppose that means, you know, going to the banks. And we saw yesterday they set aside $17 to $18 billion worth of assets to serve as collateral. But the question must be, how stable are those assets, given that they are tied to property?
Right. So that was a news report. And then the company did not confirm or deny it, which to me is a red flag, to be honest. Exactly like what you said, Brian, they do have a lot of investment assets. They own a lot of shopping malls across China. But the question is, how much are these assets worth? And by the way, are these assets being pledged away already? I mean, what we are seeing in China is that the remaining real estate developers, they're trying to parcel out their assets and float them as some form of REITs. Right. And then like state-owned enterprises can say, OK, I don't want to bail out a real estate developer, but I can buy a publicly traded REIT. But the question is, how much are these assets worth? And that's a big question mark in China right now. So
is that the only solution that the regulators, the leadership in China is able to come up with? I mean, to kind of go the route that you just described, carve them up into REITs and let kind of the investment dollars from kind of the domestic pension industry to be invested in these companies?
Well, so far, the Chinese government is still talking about so-called market-oriented solutions. Basically, they don't want to do any bailouts. And they're hoping that the financial markets will take up the risk, just like what you said, pension and insurance companies will do that. But it's really hard to do because, the whole economy is in a deflation, right? And which means that its asset prices should also be in a downward spiral trend. And we just don't know how to value these opaque commercial assets.
It could. One of the options I didn't mention was it could go to its largest shareholder, Shenzhen Metro. But it seems that that company is not that willing. What are the difficulties in that relationship at the moment?
Well, Shenzhen Metro only owns 27%. So yes, it is the largest shareholder, but it can say I'm not the majority shareholder. And the Wenke has been listed since 1991. So basically, all the mom and pops and minority shareholders, we are actually the majority shareholders, and we are not going to take responsibility
how
for
is this
Wenke's financial troubles. Yes.
So how are the difficulties at Wenke impacting entrepreneurship more broadly? You make that point, and I'm curious about that.
I think Wenke is a very interesting case study because it's so famous. And it went public before Deng Xiaoping came to Shenzhen for the Southern Tour in 1992, when the previous leader talked about the economic reforms and opening up China. And Wenke is also based in Shenzhen, and Shenzhen was the first city in mainland China that opened up its property market and allow people to own homes, right? Before that, no Chinese owned any homes. So if Wenke fails, I think it really is a death sentence, unfortunately, to Deng Xiaoping's vision.
So it seems that the government is probably the final straw here, that it can't let Evergrande and Country Garden and Wenke go down because the municipalities and the provinces have to have somebody to sell their land to, right? So is that the most likely outcome, is a state-backed bailout?
I think so. I mean, Wenke is really one of the very few privately held developers left. I mean, everyone else is state-owned, right? Like, it's basically still the state's money buying its own land. But I think right now the Chinese government, it knows its trouble, and then the trouble is just so big and daunting that it's just paralyzed. It just hopes for the best, I think, at this point.
Shuli, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time to chat with us. Bloomberg opinion columnist Shuli Ren talking about the situation with property developer China Wenke.
We look at markets all throughout the program here on Bloomberg Daybreak Asia. And joining us now for some closer analysis is Dominic Schneider, head of Global Commodities and Forex at UBS Global Wealth Management. Dominic, thanks very much for coming in. So if we take the big, broad macro view, it's been a risk-on environment here for most of the early part of this year. Just over the past month or so, it's gotten a little bit more sticky with the inflation readings in the United States. And we've seen the S&P 500 go from a gain of 10% to only up about 6% year to date. And the commentary that we got from Jay Powell today was a little bit of a change. He's really talking now about higher for longer, not being convinced that inflation is coming down to the extent that they would need it. And so one end result of that is a strong dollar. Is the strong dollar as likely as anything to disrupt the sort of, you know, positive feelings that we've had for most of this year? And is it about ready to get serious?
Well, if you look at the dollar in general, I would say we still have a little bit more to go on the strength side. I mean, we can still price out all the cuts. There are still some cuts in there. So I think from that angle, dollar strength has a little bit room to run. That means, for example, euro dollar goes to 1.05 from a temporarily below. Do I think it needs completely to alter the macro landscape? Probably not. Just pricing out in itself would not derail the economy. Obviously, if we start to think about hiking rates, that would be a complete different game changer. But we're still the opinion that inflation does decelerate, wage growth comes down, and earnings are maybe outside some of the tech names not as strong. So we don't need to make that drastic change, but it pours a little bit cold water, as you said, over some of the risk on story. And maybe that's not so bad. After a good rally, a consolidation that's good, then we need to see if growth is better outside the U.S. If that comes through, the rally can continue.
I'm wondering whether or not you feel the market is a little complacent, not a lot, but a little complacent on the level of geopolitical risk right now. I mean, you could make the case, yes, obviously a lot of the dollar strength is tied to this rate environment here that we're dealing with in the U.S., but there may have been some haven buying recently, particularly given this escalation that we've seen over the last couple of days in the Mideast. And then the second part of that is whether geopolitical risk has the potential to push commodity prices up just a little bit.
Well, I must say, I mean, at the end of the day, the Middle Eastern crisis hinges, or for the global market, it's all about what happened to oil. And I think the oil market so far thinks, okay, nobody's really interested. Things are definitely escalating, but nobody wants any disruptions on oil supply for maybe also presidential reason. You know, when you go for election, you don't want to have necessarily a higher oil price and everybody else also here in the East. So I think everybody's mind is keep oil flowing, and I think that keeps the uncertainty constrained, at least for the broader market. We also could say that in case of oil, there's probably already a $5 up to $10 risk premium in there on the supply side. But clearly, if something would happen and we get Strait of Hormuz, something like blocked, or at least we lose 1 or 2 million barrels suddenly, I think then, yeah, prices will jump quite a fair bit. And in that context, I think oil is actually a steal. If you think about it, you get an insurance asset, normally you pay for it, and here you get actually probably paid with the forward curve being downward sloped.
But one of the issues is the strong dollar. Obviously, I mean, oil priced in dollars. So if the dollar is strong, it sort of mitigates perhaps the gain in the oil price. And I'm just wondering whether or not, you know, the lack of safe havens at the moment could be, you know, changing the mix a little bit. I mean, bonds are being sold off here and yields are running to the upside. So it's not exactly that that investors are buying bonds as a safe haven. What is a safe haven at the moment besides gold and the dollar?
You rightfully said there is not really much. I think still in that environment, I would hold some commodities, to be honest, because I think in a context of the Middle Eastern crisis, holding oil makes a lot of sense. But in terms of, obviously, that comes with a fair bit of volatility, close to 30. There is not many safe haven. You might want to think about more towards Latin America. You're going to go for some of these higher yielding currencies. They're not safe haven, but they are closer to the U.S. economy. They give you good yield. I mean, that's something to maybe hide or look for a middle through pass, I would say. But beyond, I would say, dollar, gold, not much. You can look at the Swiss franc, but story is a little bit broken given what we have seen with the SMB and the policy change here, but that could come back at some point.
Talk about things that are broken in terms of havens, the Japanese currency. I mean, we're flirting here with 155. We've got JP Morgan Private Banking saying, along with Bank of America, both saying 150 or 160, I'm sorry, could be the next milestone. What's your outlook for the yen?
And we were thinking that basically in the short term, dollar yen should trade more towards the 150. Obviously, that was under the regime of thinking there's still going to be three rate cuts. Now, if rates stay high, I mean, 155 or higher is clearly possible. It's probably too early to position yourself in a long yen position, given where yield differentials are and how focused the market is at this point in time. So at this point in time, I would say yen clearly not to touch. However, I mean, let's look at the longer term picture. I mean, it is cheap. The economy does well, but we obviously really need to see the BOJ a little bit moving needle here.
Well, you're pretty equities conversant. So if we had more time, I'd ask you if the mega caps could be a safe haven, but we'll save that for next time. Those are pretty strong balance sheets. Dominic, thank you so much. Dominic Schneider from UBS.
This has been the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast, bringing you the stories making news and moving markets in the Asia Pacific. Visit the Bloomberg podcast channel on YouTube to get more episodes of this and other shows from Bloomberg. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.